Good evening, everyone. It's good to see you tonight. We are coming to the end of our winter-spring ongo. This is our intensive practice period and study period. And we will wrap things up next week. We've been led since the past few months by our student practice leader, Yuka, our Shuso. She's prepared a great program for next week, and I encourage all of you to join in for as much of it as you can. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there's information on the board. Maybe she can say a word about it tonight at the end of the evening. Looks like a great program. Then Saturday, week from Saturday, we'll have an all-day intensive here, Zazen Kai, and then Sunday, our big community event to culminate, which will be wonderful. So hopefully you can join us for some of that. And during this ongo period, we've been working with a study text from Master Dogen, great 13th century Japanese teacher, fascicle from his writings called Dotoku, or Expressions. And there have been different Dharma talks over the months about this text, and as many people have mentioned, the Japanese name for our temple is Dotokuji, the temple of true expression. So we've been looking at what is true expression in our lives and through our practice. And at the year-end retreat, I gave a talk about a historical figure who I felt his life was an example of true expression. And for those who missed it, I'll just say really capsule synthesis. This was a man named Benjamin Lay who lived in late 17th to early 18th to mid 18th century. He was a Quaker and a revolutionary abolitionist. Someone who grew up in England, had spent a little time in the Caribbean in English plantation society and had seen slavery firsthand, and then moved to North America where slavery was, of course, also deeply entrenched. And he devoted all of his days to denouncing the institution of slavery and to agitating as much as possible to bring it to an end. So he was a Quaker and an heir to a revolutionary, original revolutionary tradition within Quakerism. He was a remarkable figure. He was himself a dwarf. He was a very strict vegetarian. He practiced what his historian Marcus Rediker calls guerrilla street theater, all in the service of denouncing slavery. And he actually had an important role to play, even though he was completely marginal within his own time. His voice was a voice crying in the wilderness. He was one of the very few initial people to speak out against slavery in this country. But I really think we can say he had an important role to play. At the end of his life, the Quakers decided finally, even though that Quakers had been holding slaves and trading in slaves, they finally decided we can't continue to trade in slaves. And then a little while later, they decided we can't condone holding slaves. And the Quakers were one of the first communities to abolish slavery in their midst, anticipating the later emancipation movement in the early 19th century. So his was a small drop, but it was in a way influential and rippled out and would have significant repercussions. But his speaking truth to power, I thought, was a good example of true expression. Benjamin Lay was not a unique figure in that he was part of a tradition in England and the United States, which is referred to by historians and sort of philosophically as antinomianism. Antinomianism, anti means against, and nomianism, nomos is the Greek word for law. So antinomianism is a position against the law. And there were many different radical fringe groups in the 17th century, especially around the time of the English Revolution, that were opposed to the state or opposed to the church because they felt that these were oppressive institutions which went against the individual moral conscience and the freedom of that was inherent to people. So they denounced church and state. Many of them were religious figures, although not all. Probably the most famous person in England or the US who comes out of that antinomian tradition is the poet and illustrator William Blake. And his one of his biographers, Edward E.P. Thompson, wrote a book called Witness Against the Beast about William Blake. For Blake, the beast was the state and the church because of they were these oppressive hierarchical institutions which were antithetical to true human liberty and the natural impulse of the free man or free woman. So the spirit of the antinomians is really down with the law. Down with the law. But I wanted to talk tonight about a different current of antinomianism, and that is the Zen current. In China and Japan, there's also a long tradition of antinomianism. And even if the word antinomianism isn't familiar to you, you're familiar with this tradition probably, because it's the tradition of all of those Zen mavericks and eccentrics and madmen and Zen fools that are so much a part of the literature and are really marvelous characters. People who lived essentially outside of state control. They were not beholden to the imperial courts. They lived outside of ecclesiastical controls, oftentimes out in the wilderness, living as hermits or pilgrims, traveling about, maybe checking out temples and checking out teachers just to see what they thought, but very independent characters. And also living oftentimes outside conventional moral codes. Of course, in the Buddhist tradition, going back to India, monks were supposed to observe hundreds of laws, right? According to the Vinaya, the code of laws, a Buddhist monk was supposed to observe very strictly 250 different laws. And women who ordained were supposed to follow even more. We won't get into that. But that was how it was in East Asian Buddhist tradition as well. But there, on the other hand, there are lots of stories about monks climbing over the monastery walls at night to go drinking in the taverns. And Vimalakirti, the great lay teacher, was famous because he would frequent the brothels and not so much carousing with the young ladies, but preaching the Dharma, supposedly. But a lot of them did cavort with the ladies. And so there is this tradition within Zen. There's a really interesting historian of religion who teaches up at Columbia named Bernard Faure. He wrote a book that talks a little bit about the antinomian tradition. I think it's a pretty entertaining book. It's called The Red Thread, Buddhist Approaches to Sexuality. He focuses in particular on transgressive forms of sexual behavior. But his overall argument is actually this antinomian streak and this more strict, orderly side of Buddhism, they're two sides of the same coin. They actually reinforce one another. You can't say that Zen is just one or just the other. They're flip side of one another, the institutional side and then the anti-authoritarian side. One of the famous antinomian figures in Zen is Ikkyu. Ikkyu lived late 14th to 15th century, and as a young man training in a temple, he was known for being very critical of the Rinzai establishment. He felt the practice was really shoddy and lax. He was also known as a troublemaker. When distinguished guests would come to the temple, he would often be really rude to them. He would drink. Obviously a very brilliant guy, but kind of a problem. And so his teacher ultimately didn't transmit the abbotship of the temple to Ikkyu. He gave it to Ikkyu's Dharma brother, who Ikkyu thought was really materialist and too ambitious and all the rest. So Ikkyu ended up leaving the temple and became sort of a vagabond, traveling about, frequented the taverns and the brothels. He said spending time with the prostitutes deepened his spirituality. Later in life, he had a famous love relationship with a blind singer named Mori. And Ikkyu is also famous because he wrote lots of salacious poems. And some of them are about his love life with Mori. And I won't read the really risque ones in this setting, but here's a taste of Ikkyu. Here's one short verse of his. "This kind of madman who incites to folly, coming and going in brothels and taverns, who among you, monks with mended clothes, can find him in error? I indicate the south, the north, the west, the east." And one other short poem from Ikkyu. "From the world of passions, returning to the world of passions, there is a moment's pause. If it rains, let it rain. If the wind blows, let it blow." So I have to say, in my own case, I was drawn to Zen as a teenager because for me it really, it seemed to capture a spirit of radical freedom that was beyond institutional religious authority. I was drawn to that anti-authoritarian maverick streak. That sort of suited me politically as well. We take different things from the tradition, but that was the side that appealed to me. I remember there was an essay I read by Gary Snyder, "Buddhism and the Coming Revolution." I thought that was great. You know, late 60s, Snyder says, "The practice of meditation, for which one needs only the ground beneath one's feet, wipes out mountains of junk being pumped into the mind by the mass media and supermarket universities." Yeah. Down with the law. But of course, the antinomianism always met with criticism from the other side. Within Buddhism. And for valid reasons. If you think that you or your practice goes beyond good and evil, you can get into trouble. You may have some some experience of this yourself. I've seen teachers, Zen teachers, who think of themselves as essentially not subject to the rules that everyone else is subject to, because either because they're enlightened or because maybe everyone else treats them like they're beyond good and evil. They have a power that goes unquestioned. And I've seen, I remember one Zen teacher I saw, whenever there was an attractive young woman who was new to the community, there would be this glint in his eye and he would be after her. Or maybe it's an experience you have where you just, you feel such a breakthrough and such freedom that you feel like, you know, everything as it is fine. And I can do whatever I please right now, and it's fine. I remember in Bolivia once, I was hiking in the mountains, and I just had this incredible experience. It was so beautiful, so powerful, so intense, this kind of sacred power you could feel. And I was just really on a high. And I got in my car afterwards and I drove back into the city. I drove right through a red light and ended up in an argument with a police, a traffic cop. So, yeah. little bit of feeling spiritual power and the freedom that comes with it. It can be intoxicating, and it can get you into trouble. So the rules, all these rules that were designed for monks, you know, they really originated to try to help people train together and live together in a harmonious way. There's a reason why they came about. And so monks were expected to follow the rules and subordinate their ego for the greater good of the community. So in our current lingo, we could say that they had to be down with the law, right? I'm down with the law. I'm down with the rules. For me, the real manifestation of the freedom in Zen is Zazen. And it was, the precepts were something that I came to much later. I didn't even know they existed. They certainly wouldn't have been, they wouldn't have appealed to me when I started out. And when I did Jukai, the ceremony of receiving the precepts after I'd been, I finally broke down and started practicing with other people in community after many years. I still didn't get any instruction on the precepts. And it was only after coming to Village Zendo, where we do work on the precepts, that I started to see them and their importance and the kind of depth and subtlety that they can have. So we can work with the precepts or the rules. We don't, in the Mahayana tradition, there aren't, we don't follow 250, we follow 16. And as a lay person, if you do Jukai, you follow the 16. You vow to follow them, to try to live in accord with them. But not killing, not stealing, not abusing sexuality, not lying, not intoxicating, clouding the mind, not speaking of others' errors and faults, not elevating yourself and disparaging others, not being stingy, not indulging in anger, not putting down the teachings or the awakened mind or the community that tries to follow the teachings. But there are different ways to work with them. You know, one way is very strict, very correct and literal. Just don't kill. And then there's another way, if we call that the Hinayana way, because it's the narrow, strict interpretation. The Mahayana interpretation would be more loose, more flexible. Sometimes things are ambiguous and blurry. How do we work with that? And then there's another perspective, the Buddhayana perspective, which is the one of radical freedom in which there are no precepts. There are no laws. You can't be for them or against them. They don't even exist. I mention this in part because we just last week had a meeting for Jukai, people who might be interested in receiving the precepts this year. And so there are people I know who are thinking about that. Does this make sense for me? Would this be useful in my life? Does it fit with my practice? I think that the precepts are what I find so rich about them is that from these different perspectives, you can see they can be very profound, they can be very subtle, and they require you to work with them in different ways, according to the moment and the circumstances. And I think that all of us in our lives, we need to be aware of our own tendencies. So some of us are more more tight, or more straight, or more stiff, and some of us are more loose, or more flexible, or more blurry. We need to be aware of that. We don't have to become something else through practice. We have to be aware of our tendencies in practice. So in any given situation, am I acting appropriately here, or maybe I need to loosen up and let go a little bit, or maybe I need to tighten up, be a little more careful in this situation. So that's this is about our moral conduct, and it's also about our expression in our lives. So we can think about both freedom and discipline as parts of our practice. Just right now, can you connect with the discipline side of your practice and your life? Can you connect with the side of form? And then in this moment, can you connect with the side of freedom in your life, in your practice? Can you connect with the emptiness side? I think our Zazen practice and the practice of the precepts, both of them, can help us to actually break down a sense that these are separate things, that freedom and discipline are separate, or that form and emptiness are separate. When you're doing Zazen in your posture, freedom and discipline are right there. Form and emptiness are right there. And when you're living the precepts, there's discipline and there's freedom. So I wanted to go back to our study text because I think there's an illustration of all of this this stuff that I've been talking about that comes at the end of the text. And it's a story that you know if you've been with us these past few months. Different speakers have spoken about the story of the hermit and the abbot at the end of our study text, Dotoku. Expressions, but I'm going to read it again. It, just the essence of the story about the abbot and the hermit. In the assembly of Zuifeng, great master Zhengjue, there was a monk who built a thatched roof hermitage at the foot of a mountain. He did not shave for years. No one knew what was happening in the hermitage, and his life in the mountain was solitary. He would go to the nearby valley brook, fetch water with the wooden dipper he himself had made, and drink it. Indeed, he was a valley drinker. As he spent days and months in this way, his practice was noticed by another monk who went to see him and asked, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from India?" This is sort of a stock question, which means, what's the essence of Zen? And the hermit said, the valley is deep, the dipper handle is long. The monk was so shocked that he did not bow, nor did he ask for teaching. He just went up the mountain and told Zui Feng, the master, the story of what had happened. Hearing this, what Zui Feng said, it is quite amazing. If he is like that, I should go over and check him out. What Zui Feng meant was that the hermit seemed amazingly accomplished, but he wanted to examine how he was doing. So one day, Zui Feng had his attendant monk carry a razor and rushed to the hermitage. As soon as Zui Feng saw the hermit, he said, if you have expression, I will not shave your head. With his, the razor right there. If you have expression, I will not shave your head. And then hearing Zui Feng's words, the hermit washed his head and came back to Zui Feng. And Dogen asks, is this bringing expression or beyond expression? And then Zui Feng shaved his head. Okay. So the first thing about this story, which I think is really, really so wonderful, first thing about is Zui Feng doesn't say, now that's interesting about that hermit. Fetch him, bring him, have him come see me. No, he gets out of his seat and he goes to the wilderness and he meets the hermit there in the valley. Zui Feng is not attached to his seat. He's not stuck there within the walls of the monastery, and he's not holding on to his position of power and authority as the abbot. He goes out to encounter the hermit. He lets go of that that role he has as the supreme authority. So he shows up, and he's got the razor, and he says, if you have your expression, I will not shave your head. And Dogen says, all Buddhas and ancestors have their expression. And Dogen's asking each one of us, do you have your expression? That's what this is about for us. Each one of us must have our own expression. So he puts the monk on the spot, and he issues him a challenge. Do you have your expression? If you do, I won't shave your head, right? Shaving the head is typically the demonstration of the superior, like the host and the guest, the figure of authority shaves the head of a new monk, right, who's below him in standing. So he puts the hermit on the spot. What's he going to do? What's the hermit going to do? He has to manifest his expression. And what does he do? He goes over, he washes his head, and he goes over to Zui Feng and leans forward. And this, too, is so wonderful because the hermit doesn't hold on to his place either. Here he has been living this solitary life, totally independent and free. And he goes right up to the hermit, to the abbot. And there's nothing defensive about him. He's not clinging to his freedom and independence in any way. He says, oh, you want to shave my head? Okay. And he, with total humility. It's also a very brilliant move on this hermit's part because he's now put the abbot in a trap. because the abbot had said, he catches him in his own words and his own logic, because the abbot said, if you have your expression, I won't shave your head. And he presents his expression. He says, okay, you want to shave my head? That's fine. I don't have any problem with that. Totally free. So all of a sudden, the abbot is the one on the hot spot. And Dogen says, at this point, the abbot could have just laughed and thrown down the razor, and they would have met, and they would have met each other as equals. And that the story could have ended there. But Zuifeng was a great teacher. And so he leapt out of that trap. And he shaved the head of the hermit. And I just, more than anything else, I love that moment. Just the two of them there together, head to head, totally intimate, totally humble, totally expressing themselves. So intimate. So Dogen says about that last moment together. Know that Zuifeng checked out the hermit, and the hermit encountered Zuifeng. With expression and beyond expression, one got his head shaven and the other shaved his head. Thus, good friends of expression have a way to visit unexpectedly. Friends beyond expression have a place to be acquainted without expectation. Where there is the practice of getting acquainted, expression is actualized. So I love that, unexpectedly. You know, they're each acting completely freely and spontaneously in that situation. They meet each other completely and equally. And they are good friends of expression. And they don't even attach to their expression because they are friends beyond expression. So each of them lets go of his identity, lets go of his position, and meets the other and meets the situation as he is, just as he is. Each is acting in freedom and in discipline, in form and in emptiness, and beyond freedom and and beyond discipline and beyond form and beyond emptiness, just offering himself, just expressing himself as he is. And the hermit lowers his head to be shaved in that act of humbling himself. And at the same time, he's expressing, I indicate the south, the north, the west, and the east. And even though the abbot is contradicting himself, who among us can find the abbot in error? And if we look at ourselves, do we cling to authority, position, rules, discipline, identity? So that it's hard for us to let go? Or do we cling to our independence or our freedom and again our identity and position so it's hard to follow along? If we really attend to our practice in our lives, we can have our true expression. We can be in active, dynamic engagement with freedom and with discipline, and with rules. And we can go beyond freedom and rules in this moment. Let go of our identity, our position, express ourselves as we are right now. At the end of his life, ironically, Ikkyu was asked to become the abbot of a very important Rinzai monastery, Daitokuji, where all this training of Rinzai monks was going on. It was the head monastery for the lineage that he was in. He didn't really want to do it, but reluctantly, Ikkyu became the abbot of Daitokuji, and he helped to rehabilitate it, and he died essentially as abbot of the monastery. So I'll leave you with one last verse from EQ. Natural, reckless, correct skill. Natural, reckless, correct skill. Yesterday's clarity is today's stupidity. The universe has dark and light. Entrust oneself to change.